You may be seated. Thank you. The next case set for argument is Kevin Jute versus Nathan Schultz. Here on behalf of the appellant is Elizabeth Hertz. She'll be arguing. And on behalf of the appellee defendant is Matthew McIntosh, who'll be arguing. Each side will have 15 minutes. And then, Ms. Hertz, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, I am here today representing Kevin Jute. The central question in this case is whether SDCL 38-21-46 creates a statute of limitations or a condition precedent. This question was answered in the negative in Durham. I am here to argue that Durham is still good law and it should not be limited to claims for breach of contract. Durham is still good law because none of the subsequent changes to the statute contradict its logic, let alone overrule it. Chapter 38-21 is still about establishing administrative procedures for licensing. As 50.2 points out, penalties do not even decrease the amount of civil judgments. Nothing has been added to say that a statute of limitations or a condition precedent now exists. The legislature knows how to do this. It knows how to create a condition precedent, and it knows how to overrule a prior case. But the language we see and the language in the cases cited by Schultz and the corresponding statutes show how this is done. The legislature says things like, before a person may file a civil action, that's the North Dakota statute, cited in Laufer, or no action for the recovery of damages shall proceed. That's SDCL 3-21-2. Or going back to the 1960s Oklahoma statute, no action for damages may be brought or maintained. Or the modern version of that statute, any person failing to comply shall be barred from filing an action. Our statute said nothing like this in 1982, and they don't say it now. Durham is still good law and should have been implied in this case. Now, there's been a lot of talk in both the ruling below and in the briefing about the use of the term shall as creating a mandatory condition. But establishing something as mandatory does not establish the consequences of noncompliance. And that, again, takes us back to the statutory language. All of these statutes from other cases and other states tell us exactly what happens when you don't comply with that shall. They say something about a civil action, they bring up a civil action, and they draw that line. Once again, that is a line that was not drawn in 82 when Durham was decided, and that's a line that has not been drawn at any point since. Schultz's second argument is that the Durham rule only applies in contract cases because of how the court distinguished some cases from Oklahoma and Oregon. Obviously, I'm going to stand up today and claim that's dicta, but there are much better reasons that Durham should not be limited to contract. First and foremost, the code makes no distinction between claims like trespass, other tort claims, and contract. Because there's no distinction in the statutes, there is no reason to imply one. And the logic behind the holding in Durham is just as true for my client's claims as it was for the contract claims in Durham. Again, Chapter 38-21 is, as this court stated in Durham, about licensing. There's no talk about the type of the claim being made when the civil action comes up later. And secondly, again, as the court noted in Durham, the legislature isn't going to go create a condition precedent or a statute of limitations, and in this case, a very much limited one, bringing this to an action that has to be, if not brought, noticed within 30 days versus 6 years. If they're going to do that, they will say so.
So what is the statute there for? What's it designed to do?
This statute is
the 46 statute.
The 46 statute is designed to set up a notice for the administrative and licensing procedures set forth in the chapter in which it sits. If you look at the language in Durham, it specifically discusses what happens and what the consequences are if you don't meet this notice requirement. It says, failure to comply with the filing requirements of 38-21-46 does not affect an individual's ability to bring a claim, but rather may result in the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture refusing to hold a hearing for the denial, suspension, revocation of a license or certification for pesticide applicators.
So that's what it doesn't affect. But it seems like it has some effect on a claim against a person for damage to the crops from pesticide, because the 47 statute at 38-21-47 bars a claim against the applicator if the 46 statute, the notice statute, that's the distinction. The 47 statute says you don't have a claim if you don't have an opportunity or didn't get an opportunity to inspect it. So it seems like it does have a consequence to it.
Well, if you look to 47, the language in 47, once again, there is no statement about civil actions. And I think it's important to emphasize that going back to Durham in 1982, while the statutes have changed, there was still language about seeking reimbursement for damages. But the language that wasn't there then and isn't there now is about barring civil actions. And there are indeed penalties available under Chapter 38-21. And again, the, 50.1 states that those do not reduce damages available elsewhere.
I was actually going to say I think you could win under the 47 statute because it doesn't bar the claim for failing to give notice. It bars the claim for failure to allow an opportunity to inspect.
Precisely. The notice, and that brings us to our third point that we've raised on this appeal, that even if we do have a bar, that bar is not existing here because of substantial compliance with the statute, because of actual notice and the presentation of that opportunity for the applicator to go view the property, go view the crops, and essentially have the purposes of the statute served, even if that's how it runs. Again, I really do not think that a contract to tort distinction is valid in this case based on the statutes or based on any of the case law underlying it. Because if you look to the cases that arose underlie the dicta in Durham, they are based on different statutes, and different statutes dictate different results. And the difference between these statutes had nothing to do with a distinction between contract and tort, but specific statutory language that talked about barring civil actions if this notice requirement wasn't met. And finally, and I know we've discussed a bit of this, but that brings us to the issue of substantial compliance. It's really important to note that South Dakota law allows for substantial compliance with notice statutes. And substantial compliance exists when the purpose of the statute has been served. It's not a question of technicalities. It's a question of spirit rather than procedure. And the purpose of 38-21-46, even if you read it the way that Schulz and the court below read that statute, even if you read it that way, what it's about is giving that person a chance to go out, look at the crop, see what the damages are.
So tell me what the record shows of substantial compliance.
Well, at this point, the record is extremely bare because this was dismissed at the pleading stage. But as alleged in the complaint, that we allege, and it has yet to have been disputed, that our client gave notice to DENR of the fact that his crops had been damaged, and that the applicator, Mr. Schulz, was aware of this complaint to DENR and aware of the crop damage. Again, the factual record at this point has not been developed, but that's exactly why we're here today.
Counsel, the complaint, you said that it referred to reporting the damage, but I'm looking at your complaint, and it's referring to, it just says the defendant had actual notice of DANR's investigation of Juke's complaint. I don't see anywhere that it refers to the report pertaining to damage or, you know, what, if anything, was in the report.
But they did have, it is alleged that they had actual notice of the complaint. An actual notice means that he knew there had been a complaint to DENR, and not only that, based on what's stated, he knew that he was right next door to Mr. Yick's crops. They'd had a phone conversation, so he definitely had notice of that. And as alleged, he had actual notice of the complaint to DENR. Again, this is a point where we're trying to work off of a factual record that hasn't had a chance to have been developed because things got thrown out of court based on the conclusion that there is a procedural bar to the case.
So your argument is that you've alleged notice, let's do discovery, and they can file a motion for summary judgment if they don't think we've actually complied with the statute down the road.
Well, there's actually two aspects to that. You've gotten half of it hit the nail dead on the head. That is our argument if, and only if, Durham is held not to be precedential here, and Durham's holding that this is not a condition precedent to bringing suit is not going to apply in our case. So it's a bit of a...
No, I understand the distinction. I'm talking about under substantial compliance.
Yes, from the substantial compliance perspective, that is exactly what we're saying. You know, we've alleged it, and at this point, if we end up having to litigate substantial compliance down the line, then by all means we'll do that, but we never had the chance to do even that. Substantial compliance was just kind of shunted off to the side. And at the very least, we'd like the chance to develop that factual record and have the issue decided. And there's also the issue that my client was doing what DENR told him when they said, look, you stay out, you've done things, now just stop. He accepted that. Could he have gone and read the statute? Could he have gone and said, oh gosh, maybe I should send something in the mail? Well, that's a possibility, but the fact of the matter is he was told to stay out of it, and that is what he did. And he should not be punished for following the directions that he received.
So what's that? Is it some sort of an estoppel argument or some way that wouldn't really bind anyone other than DENR? I don't know how does that fit in?
Well, that fits in because...
It's an equitable argument. I'll grant you that. Yeah. But how does it fit into what we're doing here?
How it fits into what we're doing here is, I suppose I would call it an aspect of substantial compliance. It's a sign of him trying to do the right thing. And he was led to believe that the right thing was slightly different than what the law would state.
Is there a difference between substantial compliance and it seems that there is, substantial compliance argument and your actual notice argument?
I would say that there's a distinction, but the two are intertwined. Because substantial compliance, the reason that he substantially complied is because he met the spirit of the statute by providing actual notice. If our legislature had wanted to create an obstacle for farmers filing lawsuits for crop damage, it would have done so explicitly. Durham is good law. Durham controls in this case. My client's claims should not have been dismissed. I have nothing further, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. McIntosh, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice Jensen. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matt McIntosh. I'm an attorney at Beardsley Jensen and Lee in Rapid City. I represent the appellee, Nathan Scholes, in this matter, and we're here on an appeal of the lower court's granting of our motion to dismiss pursuant to 15.6.12b.5. Whether a complaint fails to state a claim upon which relief can be granted is a question of law that this court reviews de novo. And today my argument is going to focus on three points. The first is that SDCL 38, 21, 46, and 47 apply to all actions and are not limited to administrative actions only. That the 1982 case of Durham v. Seba Geigy Corp. is not controlling on this matter because it is factually distinguishable and because the 2020 amendments to the relevant statute superseded that opinion. And finally, that substantial compliance or actual notice or what sounds like a combination of the two is insufficient to meet the burden that's required under 38.21.46. So let me begin with a discussion about how 38.21.46 and 47 apply to all claims and not just administrative actions. This begins with an examination of statutory construction. and the court has laid down its rules repeatedly, over and over again, about how we are to construe statutes. And the intent is to discover the true intention of the law, which is to be ascertained primarily from the language expressed in the statute. We are to give words their plain meaning and effect, read statutes as a whole, and read them together when required. And I'm going to dovetail that into Justice Salter's question about 46 and possibly being more successful on the appellant side under 47. But let me continue here. When the language of a statute is clear, certain, and unambiguous, this court's role is to declare the meaning of the statute as clearly expressed in the statute. Here, 38.21.46 unambiguously states, any person claiming damages from any use of a pesticide shall notify by certified mail the pesticide applicator. The statute is clear. If a claim for damages relates to any pesticide use, that person claiming damages is required to provide notice by certified mail to the applicator. There is no limiting language. There is no context which gives us any indication that the legislator intended to limit that only to administrative actions.
But one thing that the statute doesn't do is it doesn't preclude an action if you don't give that 30-day notice. And, you know, I'm comparing that to the SDCL 3-21-2, which is the 180-day notice, which I'm very familiar with on notices to the state. And the legislature says in that statute, if you don't give that 180-day notice, no action for recovery of damages, for personal injury, property damage, et cetera, can be brought. This statute just says you have to give notice within 30 days. So could it be irrespective, and I set aside Durham for a moment, I know there's some statutory changes, but could it be the legislature intended, we got to give that 30-day notice because, you know, crops don't stay out there for very long. And so if they get harvested and defendant doesn't have an opportunity to come in to inspect and maybe test those, maybe at trial the defendant can come in and say, you know what, they didn't comply with the statute, we don't think they should be entitled to prove damages. Maybe that's something that they can argue as a defense in front of the trial court, but it doesn't seem to preclude a lawsuit. Can you speak to that?
I can, Your Honor, and I think it makes it easier when we look at the North Dakota statute, because what North Dakota did is they took what is 46 and 47 and just created one statute. And that's really what we have here is identical statutes. There's a little bit of different language that I'm going to touch on. But North Dakota, their relevant statute is just one long statute that encompasses both 46 and 47 in nearly identical language. But 46 is the notice provision. If you have damage to crops related to any pesticide use, you are to provide notice. 47 then ties into that because the first line of 47 says, upon notifying the applicator as required under 38.21.46. It ties in directly to 46 and 47. And we have been told by this court repeatedly that when statutes are connected, we're to read them together. So,
doesn't that drive towards the inspection? You know, you're going to permit the applicator and up to four representatives to go out and look at the crop, et cetera.
It does. It's part of it, Your Honor. And that's because it relates to having the notice. Once you have the notice, you've triggered the right to the inspection. As the lower court discussed in its opinion, if you don't have the notice, you can't have the inspection. And that'll take us to substantial compliance here shortly. But that's where these two statutes tie into one another. You can have an inspection, and if you deny the inspection, there is no doubt that you're barred from bringing a claim. But how do you get to the inspection? In 46, you have to provide notice to the applicator. And that's how these two statutes tie into one another.
You know, I'm not really sure, and I'm still thinking about it, and I appreciate both counsel's arguments, but I'm not really sure that these statutes really have much to do with licensing applications at all. It seems like the 46 statute, and I could be totally wrong, but it seems like the 46 statute is what I might call an anti-spoliation statute. And it's designed to neutralize the argument from a would-be defendant who's accused of damaging someone's crimes that the applicator was denied an opportunity to inspect and investigate this damage during the growing season. And this statute would, and these two statutes would allow for that opportunity so that a would-be defendant applicator doesn't find himself or herself hamstrung by the lack of evidence. What do you think about that?
I think that's 100% correct, Your Honor. I believe that that's exactly what this these two statutes were designed to do were to provide a prevention of spoliation of evidence, in that the nature of this type of case is one, as Chief Justice Jensen mentioned, it's very difficult because these types of things dissipate quickly. You may lose your opportunity to provide yourself a defense.
But that's different. Proving up the case and whether they can prove damages and whether you've had a fair chance to defend the case, that's a different question than do they have the ability to come in and file a lawsuit and ask the court to resolve this question. And that's really what we're talking about here. We're not at that second point yet. And so does that matter?
I don't think it matters because of the way the statute's written. The legislators meant what they said, and they said what they meant. They said you have to provide notice. And the reason that they have created the statute that they did are for the reasons we've just discussed. The legislator was clear in its intention that because evidence leaves so quickly in this nature, we have to make this a condition precedent or precedent, depending on where you went to law school. And it's a requirement to ensure that these types of things don't occur. All that is required under this statute is to provide certified mail. It's not an onerous standard. It's simply put mail in the mailbox by certified mail so that you could send proof, and then you continue to have your normal period of statute of limitations. It's one thing that the South Dakota Supreme Court, this court, discussed in Durham was that it was concerned about a disparity in the statute of limitations. In that case, one about a contract case which would provide a 4-year statute of limitations, this court felt that a 30-day period would create too much of a disparity between 30 days and 4 years. Well, it's not truly a disparity if it's a condition precedent, because what we have here is a simple compliance requirement that you file the notice and then you maintain your 4-year statute of limitations and contract, or 3 in property damage. So it's not truly a disparity at all, which is one of the reasons that the Durham case is no longer controlling, because it has been superseded by that opinion, or excuse me, the amendments in the 2020 statutes. Another issue that I would point out in the context of Justice Salter's question is that this is not just a statute, a chapter about administrative functions. And we can tell because in the Durham case, the Supreme Court said this is primarily an administrative chapter. It doesn't apply to cases that sound mostly in tort. And they looked at the penalty. The penalty, if you failed to comply at that time, was that the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture could refuse to take any action against that applicator's license, revoking, modifying, or otherwise. Well, that has changed entirely with the statutes when they were modified in 2020. What happens now is that there is not only a requirement that a notice is provided, but the punishment is that you can't bring your claim anymore. That's a significant departure from where this court was at in 1982 when its decision relied on the 1974 versions of these statutes. So there have been a number of changes that have occurred to those statutes which demonstrate, one, that the legislator intended for this chapter to be far more encompassing than just administrative actions. And it also demonstrates that the opinion has been superseded by those amendments in 2020 to the relevant statutes at hand.
But the statute, and I'll use this term maybe a little inartfully, but the statute doesn't contemplate a self-executing consequence of noncompliance in the same way that, for instance, 321.2 does, that the 180-day notice to public entities. This one doesn't really provide that kind of, and the Chief talked about that. This one really doesn't provide for that built-in self-executing consequence. You can't bring an action if you don't do this. It just kind of leaves it there. And even if there is statutory noncompliance, how do we know that it's truly prejudicial unless there's a spoliation argument, I suppose. But how do we know that that's the consequence necessarily that the legislature intended?
If I understand your question correctly, I think it again requires us to read both statutes together. Because when you read 46 and 47 together, there is your requirement that is a self-executing bar to a claim. And so 46 requires notice. 47 says upon notifying
the applicator. Oh, I see already. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, so upon notifying the applicator as required in 46, okay. Now we've tied in two statutes together, and it says then the person seeking reimbursement shall permit the applicator and up to 4 representatives to enter the property. Failing to do so, the person is barred from asserting the claim. So it's there that you have the two that are tied in together, and you cannot simply have the request to inspect the property without the notice. That was an argument that was presented at the lower court and has been briefed, is that, well, actual notice was provided. The appellee should have requested the right to inspect the property then at that point. Well, that really reverses the burden in this case. The statute, the legislator said the burden is on the party claiming damages, not the person that's being accused. It's so, very.
So does this tie into your substantial compliance argument?
It does, Your Honor.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know you're getting down.
I will, Your Honor. Substantial compliance, it's an interesting argument. I had some trouble conceptualizing what position they were taking, and that's been clarified today, is that actual knowledge suffice for substantial compliance in this case, I believe is the position that the appellant is taking. And I think they have to take that position because substantial compliance in its general sense requires that the statute has been actually followed sufficiently to carry out the substance essential to every reasonable objective of the statute. So what is the statute required? It requires certified mail to be sent to the applicator within 30 days or before 25% of the crop is harvested. Well, none of those things were done. Zero. Not one of those things was done. Instead, the appellant sent notice to the DANR, and that is not even a person listed in the statute. You cannot substantially comply. You can't attempt to actually follow sufficiently if your attempt is zero out of three. That is simply not substantial compliance with the statute. So then we turn to what is their other argument, and that is that, well, we've complied with the substance essential to every reasonable objective of the statute. And I believe the parties agree that the objectives of the statute are that the party claiming damages is to provide the notice to the applicator so that the party knows that the party claiming damages is saying, hey, this was your fault. And then two, it provides the applicator an opportunity to inspect and prepare a defense. Those are really the heart of what these statutes are designed for. And Justice Devaney, she mentioned this earlier in her question to counsel. She said, well, what exactly is it that we're saying was the notice at this point? And what we have in the complaint, because that's where we're at in this procedure, is that this was a motion to dismiss based on the complaint. So we're stuck with the allegations, and we're accepting them as true for our purposes of this appeal. The sole allegation in that regard is defendant had actual knowledge of DNR's investigation of Jupp's complaint.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that. Is that enough? Is that sufficient under our standard?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's simply not enough because having knowledge of their investigation is not getting to the heart of what is the reasonable objective of the statute. The statute is designed to say, I am going to sue you for damages to my crops. That's the notice that we're saying is required. All that has been actually provided to the appellee in this case is that he had notice of an investigation by an agency in South Dakota. That is not the equivalent. That is not actual notice. It's actual notice of an investigation, but is not actual notice sufficient to meet the burden under 382146. So as I wrap up here on my time, my client is respectfully requesting that this court affirm the decision of the trial court, which dismissed the appellant's complaint, as there is no set of facts in support of his claim which would entitle him to relief. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you, Mr. McIntosh. Ms. Hertz, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Scholz's interpretation of the code is not reading clear and unambiguous language. It is adding words. The North Dakota statute that is claimed to be nearly identical, well, the problem is one of the differences is that the nearly part includes the exact words before a person may file a civil action. And that is a distinction with a serious difference. The court has made an analogy here to the law of spoliation. And I think it's worth considering that in most civil cases, spoliation of evidence does not prevent you from bringing a claim. Spoliation doesn't lead to dismissal generally, unless it's egregious. You know, the typical thing is you get your jury instruction that you can infer that this evidence was bad. Again, it's not, you're not barred from bringing your claim to court, and unless things are really bad, your case isn't thrown out.
Well, the legislature could say, as maybe they have in North Dakota, I don't know, but the legislature could say, as a matter of public policy, you don't get a claim if there's spoliation. And that's our legislative judgment. Common law spoliation rules notwithstanding, that's what we've determined as a legislature and as the duly elected public policymaking body of the state of South Dakota. The question really is here, that just begs the question of whether they did that here or not.
Well, I think the question of whether it did that or not is about a slightly different issue than whether notice was given. The way that 38-21-47 reads is essentially, I guess you bring your analogy back to those egregious cases where the farmer has refused entry. If there is indeed a bar, that's where the bar rises. When somebody has said, you're not allowed on my land to look at these damages I'm claiming. And that's never happened here.
Is the allegation that Schultz had actual notice of the DANR's investigation enough to survive a motion to dismiss under 12b-5?
Yes, it is, because actual notice of the investigation means that he knew something he did in spraying pesticides was being investigated.
Yeah, but it seems, and maybe that's exactly what it means, but it seems like it's one step removed. It doesn't say he had actual notice that there had been this damage or there had been this overspray. It says that he has notice of the investigation. Is that, don't worry about that difference, or is that a meaningful difference?
I don't think that's a meaningful difference, because the investigation was precisely the investigation of an overspray on land where he knew, as alleged in the complaint, he knew the owner and had spoken to him. And knowing about the investigation, that is enough to put somebody on notice of inquiry. And notice of inquiry is precisely what that statute is about. It's precisely what that's about. Give you a chance that, hey, maybe there's something here I should look into. Maybe I should take a look at this crop damage and see what's going on. That notice was existing. That notice was alleged. Substantial compliance existed here. And talking about the steps for substantial compliance, it's not about the steps. Again, it's about accomplishing the purpose of the law. It's not about certified letters. It's not about any of that. It's about somebody being able to know that, hey, there is a reason for me to go out and take a look at this ground and see what the crop damage looks like.
How about the time of the notice? Is there something specified in the, I mean, I don't see a specific time specified in the complaint as to when DANR was noticed. Statute requires it within a certain defined time frame.
And once again, that is something where we should have been allowed to develop the record. Substantial compliance wasn't even considered. It was just kind of ignored. And
But your complaint doesn't say he had actual notice within 30 days.
It does not say he had actual notice within 30 days, but it said he had actual notice, and I believe actual notice is enough to imply the 30 days. Once again, the entire problem with this case is that when you're considering questions of substantial compliance, we're forced to work off an incomplete record because of how it went down. There's not been a chance to go into these facts of who knew what when. And again, those facts only come up as an issue if we overstep the fact that we have case law and statutes that haven't changed to the point where they specifically tell you this is a bar.
But isn't that the nature of a motion to dismiss? It's always based on the pleadings at this stage, and that's all those cases are tried that way, right? Or decided that way.
I would agree, but at the point of talking about, well, did actual notice encompass the 30 days or not, I would say that actual notice in a notice pleading system ought to be enough, and splitting hairs about what actual notice entails and whether the specific date deadline was met is not necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Hertz.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.